Well, good afternoon and welcome to Preparing for the Future Wealth Management Landscape. I'm Melinda Howes, I'll be your chair today. So it's my great pleasure to introduce Daniel Levy, who'll be giving the presentation. Daniel's recently joined PricewaterhouseCoopers advisory practice as a director. He has over 15 years' experience in financial services, working at Tower, MLC and a UK super consulting firm. What, we're not naming them, Daniel? Okay. He's worked in a variety of roles in the wealth management industry, including chief operating officer, managing a dedicated change team, and of course actuarial. He's been responsible for product development and rationalisation, unit pricing, custody and settlements operations, including process re-engineering, remediation and outsourcing, customer and advisor service delivery, process improvement and systems, and advice to trustees on benefit design, investment strategy, and funding of defined benefit pension schemes. Please join me in welcoming Daniel Levy.
Thanks, Melinda, and thanks everybody for coming along to hear me talk about the future of financial services. We're here to talk about the Henry Cooper and Ripoll reviews, and As most of you probably appreciate, it's a vast topic, 1,800 pages of recommendations and findings. I'd love to keep you here all year, but I suspect you might have better things to do. So I'm just going to skim the surface, so opportunities at the end to ask questions, to get into a bit more detail on any particular topic you like. That's great. My wife said, bit of a dry topic, you need a joke. Always start with a joke. So she typed in superannuation and joke into Google, and it came up with nothing. Sorry about that. Anyway, so the process I've gone through to putting this presentation together is I've gone and spoken to a couple of dealer groups, a couple of fund managers, a couple of industry funds, and of course a couple of retail players. So it's kind of a snapshot. Obviously not, I haven't spoken to everyone, but and I've just tried to put together some themes from those conversations. And first of all, I'd just like to thank everybody that did help me put this presentation together. So what are some of the key themes or key issues we're going to be talking about? First of all, commoditization of advice and superannuation, and some thoughts on transitioning your business from where it is today, and also some opportunities that arise out of the change. So, and then finally we'll look at some of the high-level impacts that my crystal ball tells me about the industry going forward. So, first of all, let's just recap on the background and the need for change. So, obviously, people are saying, it's not broken. Why do we need to change it? The system's not broken. So, some of the observations, superannuation's compulsory. It's a key part of Australian savings. The government recognises that there's apathy amongst most Australians towards their superannuation, recognise that it's compulsory, and as such the government's got a responsibility to make sure that the public gets the best outcome from that compulsory savings. There's also a view that there are blockages in the system, which means that competition is not leading to the best outcome. So that's some of the drivers on superannuation. On advice, there have been, we all know, high-profile failures of advice, Storm, Opus Prime, so something needs to change. On tax, the burden is thought to be shared inequitably amongst the public, and the tax system is creating inefficiencies in the industry. So the quote that I like is that regulatory reshaping is required. So looking specifically at the reviews, I'm assuming some level of knowledge based on reading newspapers and that sort of stuff, so I'm not going to go into any particular review into a lot of detail, but just the high levels on Cooper, there's proposals for MySuper, SuperStream and compulsory provision of intra-fund advice. We'll look at each of those in a bit of detail. On Ripoll, driven out of the failure of Storm Financial, now been largely superseded by government's proposals around the future of financial advice. And the key things there, no commissions, fiduciary responsibility for trustees, which we'll spend, for advisors, which we'll spend some time looking at, and also provision of professional advice. on the Henry Review, 138 recommendations. In my view, the government's ruled out or postponed some of the key measures that will be industry changing. But obviously, we've got to recognise increasing SG from 9 to 12% and a couple of other things around there will be industry changing as well. I'm not particularly planning to talk much about Henry Review for the reason that some of those things have been, the more significant things in my view, have been ruled out. So, first of all, looking at Cooper's My Super proposals, I raise the question, does superannuation become a commodity? So, looking at some of the features of a commodity, and My Super for that matter, trustees, all default superannuation funds are going to need to be certified. And they need to be certified that they have prescribed features, a single investment option, retirement income product. They're going to have prescribed services, provide intra-fund advice, and use e-commerce, specified standards around e-commerce. There's going to be a compulsory focus on the cost of superannuation, removal of cross-subsidies, and also the focus on cost. Trustees are, may well start rethinking their investment strategy, increased use of index tracking to bring the cost down so that their cost is comparable to other funds. Also, a requirement on My Super trustees to have scale. They've got to deliver value for money for their members, or they've got to merge. So all of this together, it sounds like a commodity to me. So let's just pause briefly there and just think about what are some of the debatable points. So will commoditisation of superannuation increase consumer apathy and reduce choice? Well, why bother? You're just taking a super fund that's perfectly fine at the moment, just carving out a bit of it and calling it My Super. Why bother? So how do you differentiate when the product's a commodity? Will industry funds look like any different to retail corporate funds? And will some funds actually remove choice for members in this new world? Oh, this slide looks very familiar. This is actually about single issue advice. So raise the question now, will single issue advice look like a commodity? So I'm calling single issue advice the combination of intra-fund advice provided in super funds and also similar type of simple single issue advice provided outside of super. I think the features are similar, and so I've coined the term single issue advice here to describe those. So again, let's look at the features, prescribed features. Single issue advice must be provided on insurance, retirement income planning, transition to retirement. There are specified services. The prescribed services are compulsory in superannuation. And perhaps a more subtle point is, as we'll look at in a minute, the advisor's fiduciary responsibility to provide best interests advice. If a client comes in the door and of a full service advisor, one of the first decisions I would have to speculate is that the advisor needs to make the decision about whether full service advice is in the best interests or a single issue advice is in the best interests of the client. So I also see the fiduciary responsibility as pushing through a focus or is prescribing that advisors provide single issue advice as well. So focus on cost. Trustees have to deliver value to their members. And anyway, single issue advice, members aren't going to pay, or the public's not going to pay a lot for single issue advice. So, and then building scale. I would put forward there's a significant unmet demand in the middle Australian market for advice. And this type of advice can only be delivered cost effectively with the extensive use of technology. So again, there's a whole lot of things converging on here that says you need scale. Overall, sounds like a commodity to me. Oops, sorry, going too fast there. Some of the debatable points on this. Why is that service not provided in the market today? Has the industry overcomplicated advice? If advice becomes trusted, will it be demanded? Should the trustee be charging fee for service for their intrafund advice? Does intrafund or single issue advice lead to suboptimal outcomes for the customer? You know, the single issue advice doesn't consider the wider needs. Does that mean they're going to be worse off? An interesting perspective here is that advice is focused on telling members what to do, not increasing their financial confidence. So should advice be in a more mentoring capacity rather than a telling capacity? Moving on to talk about full service advice. So born out of the Ripple Inquiry, the government's got specific proposals now for the future of financial advice. The key driver of that is to increase advice or promote advice as a profession and to gain public trust. That's what the government would like. So the planks of that, increasing professional standards, ASIC having an increased monitoring role or policeman role of advice, and what's coined now product neutral advice. So advice that it focuses on the member or the customer's needs without considering the product, and then brings in the product and the selection of the product shouldn't be influenced by remuneration of the advisor. So removal of commissions and removal of volume related payments, and moving to a fee for service, as we know, and the annual renewal process for advice. So just like your general insurance, every year you get a renewal slip from your advisor, and the advisor, and you have to return that renewal slip in order to continue getting advice from the advisor. So, and then finally, the final plank is fiduciary responsibility. This is going to be the most controversial thing. How do you make sure you advise in the best interests of clients? So overall, the outcome here that we're looking at is increased public trust and advice by aligning the client and the advisor's interests and increasing the standards to remove the rogue element in the industry. So moving again on to some of the debates, fiduciary responsibility, what does that mean? How do you provide best interest advice when there are thousands of products in the marketplace? Is it just this whole thing all about the fact that a few poor advisors have tarnished the reputation of all the good advisors out there? Will the transparency on fees reduce demand for full service advice? What about the need for advisors to keep an eye on the investment portfolio? How's that going to happen with this annual renewal process? And what happens if the client cancels or doesn't renew their advice contract? Who's to blame if something goes wrong as a consequence of that? Do advisors actually play that role of actually have that ongoing monitoring today, you know? And will they need to in MySuper? What happens in MySuper? And another sort of interesting perspective is in the trustee space. Have trustees actually let their members down by not having life stage funds or providing advice to make sure that when members approach retirement, their portfolio moves to eliminate the volatility risk? So they've had a good ride over a number of years with rising markets. For the last couple of years, there have been a lot of members that are disappointed by what their trustees have or haven't done. So, future of financial advice. Let's look now at some of the transitioning aspects, as well as some opportunities, and then we'll move on to consider some of the impacts, a couple of high-level impacts on the industry. So, preparing for the future of financial advice, to transition there, you need to consider your advice proposition. What value add are you providing to customers? Look at changes to your income, you know, advice fees and other remuneration. All those sorts of things are going to change. Make sure your staff remuneration practices are product neutral. Obviously, all the compliance stuff, statement of advice processes, approved product lists, all those sorts of things need to be updated. Need to transition your advisors to the new practices, educate them, licensing, relicensing. I put forward that that's an easier job for the big boys and the boutiques. The boutiques, because they rely much more on the individual capabilities. They don't have extensive systems and processes to change. The big boys, because they've got the scale to deliver it effectively. Also see opportunities. So you're going to have to look through your advice process, reconsider it, all the paperwork and that sort of stuff, make it efficient. If you're going to look into the single issue advice, there's a potential big market there. You've got a potential to build a scalable model there. You can grow by building trust in your clients and your members of your super fund and your customers. Educate them and develop the trust to grow their loyalty going forward. And it might sound like I'm talking about advice businesses, but I'm also talking about super funds here as well. So again, some of the points of debate that I've heard. What does a fiduciary responsibility mean? That keeps coming up. Will current advisors make the transition to these new professional standards and the new remuneration practices? What about legacy commission streams? If you've got a customer coming in for an annual renewal and they're being charged a commission, is that in the best interest of the client? Equally on corporate retail, where there's a planned service fee. If they're currently being charged it and not receiving advice, what do you do about that? So looking at preparing for my super, we've got, unlike advice, we've got to recognise that there's no government proposal on my super yet. So slightly more crystal ball gazing here, but again, my super proposals, certification of all default super funds. So you've got to redesign your product. So you've got the product here, split out the my super bit, and decide what to do about the choice element. You've got to segregate your accounting and remove your cross subsidies between MySuper and other parts of your super fund. You've got to build or enhance your interfund advice. That's going to be a big challenge for a lot of super funds. You update your straight through processing technology to comply with the new e-commerce standards, and also implement new governance responsibilities imposed by MySuper. Again, change. Opportunity. So you've got the opportunity to build scalable advice and administration business. Others have the obligation, other super funds have the obligation to consider scale. Can you benefit from the fact that they're subscale, mergers or, for example? Also, as we'll look at in a minute, there's SuperStream is going to make account member account consolidation a lot easier. So can you win out of super member account consolidation? Also, looking at the investment strategy, this focus on cost is an opportunity to rethink your investment strategy and make sure it's actually delivering the value to members that that it may not be today or it needs to be in future. And overall, I believe if you take the lead on interaction with your members, there will be a whole lot of benefits in terms of loyalty and attracting new customers into your super fund down the track. Again, some of the more controversial debated points on this. Well, as I mentioned before, what's the benefit of splitting my super from the other choice features of your super fund today? Will commoditisation of MySuper actually lead everyone down the path to indexed management of their funds? How do you differentiate under MySuper? Is it actually just going to be industry funds and retail all look the same to everyone? So, Cooper, so considering some of the high-level impacts on the industry, first of all, looking at SuperStream, the impacts of SuperStream. So, Cooper's said that you need to implement there are service standards around new member processing, contributions and rollovers. So there's consensus amongst the people I've spoken to that it will improve efficiency in the industry. So super funds should have reliable data. There'll be compulsory use of e-commerce or electronic standards there, and the use of straight-through processing and reduction in rework because of the reliable data should reduce cost per member. However, account consolidation. So better data matching, transparency for everybody where members have multiple accounts and multiple super funds. Funds are likely to promote consolidation, and with a tick the box option you can consolidate your super very easily. So it's likely to result in a reduced number of superannuation accounts. So doesn't that mean the cost per account actually goes up? So the interesting thing there, cost of the industry going down, but from a member perspective, depending on how quickly this consolidation occurs, the cost that the members will see may well go up. So debatable points here. So will all this new electronic stuff actually increase the work for small business? Small businesses don't necessarily have computers. And how do you actually make it compulsory for someone to use e-commerce anyway? So another point, should consolidation be compulsory or opt-in? So various debates around whether people want the insurance in their inactive funds or not, and whether multiple employers will create issues with compulsory consolidation. And then who's going to be the winners and losers out of consolidation? You know, spoken to industry funds and retail, they're both saying, oh, it's about the same. So is that right? Well, one of the observations is, what portion of your members in your fund are inactive? So I've heard figures from 30% inactive to 70% active. To me, that is probably a likely driver. So look at your fund and see where you are there. Another high-level observation is that I can see advantages or greater advantages going forward in combining product and distribution under one organisation. So again, this is some observation, who knows, a bit of crystal ball gazing. But we have a look in the retail space. We've got the retail players have multiple advice models. They can get a client in and they can direct them into the most effective advice model for that member, acting in their best interests. Big players can also provide greater support to advisors and even absorb the cost of advice into revenues from the product. Also, in the big end of town, they control the trustees, and the control of the trustee enables them to control the intra-fund advice, so there's a big opportunity there in that space too. So I would say that product and distribution is a winning combination in the retail space. Moving on to industry funds. I would argue that industry funds control distribution today. They've got employers bringing them members every day, new members coming into industry funds every day. There's a requirement for under MySuper for industry funds to be big. And they can market cost-effective advice very easily to their members. And so I again say industry funds is essentially combining the product and distribution, and I see industry funds also continuing to be dominant and perhaps even increased dominance in the market. So the more difficult one to analyse is the independent licensees. So we've got a removal of product remuneration to those licensees. So we can see, licensees are now talking, well, why don't I become the product manufacturer, take on those roles, become the trustee, become the RE. I control the pricing margins. And so they're essentially saying, yes, there's power in having product and distribution together. I need to be in that combined product and distribution space in order to deliver that service at an acceptable cost to customers. But we've also got to recognise that there will also be highly successful independents that can succeed by being independent. So that's the sort of perhaps more boutique where they charge fee for service and they have an established high net worth client base that's prepared to pay for that service. And also the self-managed super funds segment, where that service almost certainly needs to be that fee-for-service full advice. So bringing all that together, I see life is easier if you've got product and distribution combined. You can control the end-to-end pricing, you've got control over the access to clients, and if you've got scale, that will also be a key determinant in your success. Some of the debated points again. Most controversial, should the award system of nominating default funds in the awards be allowed or abolished? Also, why shouldn't manufacturers pay their distributors for outsourced distribution? And will the mid-size independents be able to survive? And is it actually good for customers to have smaller organisations fulfilling the trustee and responsible entity roles? So, in conclusion, it's obviously going to take time. And it's still speculative, but I see MySuper creating commoditisation and superannuation. I see the combination of the future financial advice and MySuper commoditising single issue advice. I think the scale of your business will be critical. I see success in the big and the boutique, and challenges for the mid-size organisations. That's driven off the economics of change, and the drive to commoditisation will drive the need for scale and efficiency. And the obligations, trustee obligations on MySuper to deliver value for money also drives the need for scale. Any change? Opportunity. So, question is, single issue advice, I believe, is a big new market. I think there's an opportunity to make sure when you're doing all this navel gazing at your advice processes, working out how to respond, make it efficient this time. And I believe that the change is favouring product and distribution combined. So that's all I had prepared to talk about, and it's open for questions. And in case you don't have any, there's some provocative ones up there.
Okay, so we've got around half an hour for questions. So I've got a number here that I'd like to ask. Give you the opportunity to go first. Who would like to ask the first question?
Have you worked out how to do it? On the end, is that right? Yes.
All right. Well, my question to you is, what would the difference be between a system where most customers pay commission, which is what we have now, whether they're having advice or not, and a system where the one entity owns the product and the distribution, so the costs of the distribution model are built into that business model and are in effect shared by all customers? So, you know, are we really just getting to the same end result through a different route with the ban on commissions?
I think that depends on which place in the market you're playing. So if you're in the high net worth space where customers value the relationships and they've got the wealth to pay the fee for service, then I think that's a sustainable part of the market. When it comes to the mid-market, I think the needs are different, and this is where I see the business model has to, triage customers as they come in to make sure that the fiduciary responsibility of the advisor means that they don't over-service the client. The transparency that customers will get with the removal of commissions will change the focus from advisors selling product and advice to advisors selling advice as a professional service. So I think that's some key changes in attitude, and you know, maybe seems subtle now, but I think when the customers come to view that world, it will actually seem quite different, and it's something where customers will be able to see the value add in moving from the single issue advice that you can get through that triage process through to the full service advice.
Just one more from me and then you guys get a chance to. The big elephant in the room on this commission debate is, and the thing that the Institute I think could be asked by journalists is, well, you know, you've everyone's, well, Ripple have said remove commissions on superannuation. The next logical step is to remove commissions on insurance. Now, what position should the Institute take on that one? Nice, easy question for you. Or what are people... do you think that will happen? Do you think that's the next logical step?
Look, I think there is a difference, and it's a subtle difference, between insurance and the investment products. Insurance is arguably a product rather than a service. And as a product, I go, it's like buying a TV. You know what the features are, you know what the cost is. So you know the benefits of insurance, you know what the cost of insurance is. It's actually readily comparable by customers. Whereas investment services, you don't know what the outcome is going to be, and you don't really know what the cost is going to be. So it's a lot more difficult for customers to compare that. So that's like a builder. You contract a builder, they're providing a service to you, and I know it's very difficult to actually know what it's going to cost at the end of the day, because the builder doesn't know what it's going to cost at the end of the day. It's very difficult to know exactly what it's going to look like at the end of the day. There's a whole raft of things there that make it a lot more difficult when you come to the investment services. So overall, I suspect that if you look at commissions across the whole of society, commissions have a bad name across the whole of our society. And so I think it looks to me like it's inevitable that sooner or later commissions will be removed from insurance. But that's just a personal view on that.
Hey, next question. Could you please just state your name and where you're from?
Chris Johnson, Trinary Consulting. I was wondering what your thoughts were on how the Cooper Review, if at all, is going to remove, or how the outcomes from the Cooper Review, if at all, is going to remove investor apathy, and also how it's going to achieve the competition it's trying to engender in the industry, so reducing the fees from whatever the average fee is now to something along the lines of what the American industry, for instance, has. My view is that the commoditization of super more or less makes buying a super product like buying a bank loan, but because you're paying the fee out of your super balance, you don't actually care what the bank charges you in interest, whereas most people do care what the bank charges them in interest because it comes out of their back pocket. So why should anyone care what their funds charges them?
We see some apathy around that until members become aware of what they're charged. And I think the increased disclosure with members around what fees are being charged has got to be good for members' education there, and allowing members to make choice. The commoditisation I see is inevitable, and obviously that drives focus on cost, and this is why I believe the flow on for that is the trustees have got to reconsider or may reconsider their investment strategy and decide whether the investment strategy is actually beneficial to members. So if you look at Australia compared with other countries in the world, the level of indexed management in Australia is very low. You know, why is that? Much better investment. Australian investment managers, no comment.
Next question.
So, Tim Gorse from the NAB. I know this point wasn't covered in your presentation, but in the last couple of years, deposit products have become a lot more competitive as an investment vehicle. And I'm wondering whether you've got a view on how deposit products might reshape the wealth landscape going forward.
Well, interesting, of course, one of the announcements that the government made in the budget is to make...
That one's very soft.
Is to make traditional bank deposits more attractive.
So that might be a small contributor there. Look, I mean, primarily the commoditisation I'm talking about here is in the compulsory superannuation space. So I think I'm not saying that the traditional platform space doesn't have a significant role. It does have a significant role. It has a significant role among with those customers with higher net worth, greater needs for sophistication in terms of the product features and that sort of stuff. And in that space, just like those sort of products have featured strongly in the last couple of years, with people taking a more pessimistic view of growth assets, I think it plays a role in that space going forward. I think sentiment amongst on the market will, in terms of growth versus defensive assets, is going to drive that more than anything else, I would say.
Anyone for another question or comment? Diatribe?
Lawrence Haim from Health Super, which is an industry fund, and I'm contracting now. Two questions around industry funds. Out of Cooper, there's talk that under My Super, you wouldn't be able to spend or allocate expenses for things like advertising. In my fund, which is a life cycle default fund, over 90% of members choose that default. So do you have any view on how far Cooper will push that? And also, how far do you think he'll push the merging of smaller funds?
I think smaller funds are going to have challenges in achieving scale. And that's going to determine whether the trustees can put their hand on their heart and actually saying they're delivering value for members. Now, in saying that, there are a number of ways of delivering scale. You can deliver scale by having a large administrator behind you. You can deliver scale in advice by making sure that you have a large advice provider behind you. You can provide scale by making sure you've got a large fund manager behind you. So it's not clear to me that, the method of delivering scale could be quite different, but the fact is that the trustees are going to would have this responsibility to ensure they deliver value for money for members. In terms of things like advertising, that's way too controversial. it's the same issue that maybe the trustees will continue to be able to justify promotion of their fund, their My Super fund. I don't know. It'll be a tough call when it comes to is it delivering value for those members. And if Cooper's thoughts on the trustees' increased focus, I should say, on delivering value for members and the removal of cross subsidies between different types of activities is actually as strong as it sounds, then I think the trustees will have difficulty justifying the advertising.
Next question.
Michael O'Neill from Investors Mutual. I just wanted to ask a question about your opinion of the role of the asset allocation decision, either in the default or within a single form advice, and whether you see, given the controversy around that, whether you see that there could potentially be some unintended consequences there.
I mean, I think there are unintended consequences today. So if you get single issue advice and you have a piece of advice that says you should be invested in the balanced option, great. The trouble is the follow through on that. Is that the right thing in 10 years' time? Is that the right thing in 20 years' time? Have you made sure that the member's actually going to be proactive and come back? Or have you a responsibility as trustee to go back to the member and make sure you re-advise them at certain points in time? So there's that question. That's one way of solving the problem. The other way is the life stage fund. But then, do you target your life stage fund at retirement, or do you do it at the, as the question was before we came to the conference, do you target it at retirement, or do you target it at the date that the life expectancy is expecting them to die at?
you've got to know or have some understanding about how the members are using are going to use their money to make that investment decision for them. So no easy answers, I'm afraid. That's the trouble with trustees looking after members with a whole wide of range of needs, and it's difficult.
Do we have another question?
I'm Robin Knight from ING. I spend a lot of my time providing group insurance to industry funds. They would certainly believe that with the removal of commissions, they're already providing advice, they've got their cost structures under control. They're obviously very confident, but their belief would be that they would grow and grow. Some of the smaller industry funds would disappear, but the retail market would struggle to compete alongside them. You've expressed a different view, that you believe the retail funds will continue to prosper. Why aren't the industry funds right?
Oh, I think the people I've spoken to have both said that their belief is that the industry fund segment and also the retail segment would continue to thrive. I mean, both provide, under my super, both provide very similar products. Both have corporate arrangements, and at the end of the day, there's a range of needs in the public, from the simple needs that are going to be met with my super and the platform space that meets other needs. So I think there continues to be a variety of needs and different solutions.
It's interesting, if you look at the Rice Warner projections, they project those different sectors of the market as to how big they'll be in 15 years' time, and I think they're saying industry funds will gain market share more quickly than retail, but retail will continue to grow, but industry funds in 15 years will be the biggest segment according to that projection.
That's certainly industry funds
view. Another question or comment?
My name's Ray Murray and I'm from an industry fund, SunSuper. I made a comment in another meeting. I actually think that one of the big changes will be that we will have competition for the first time from the banks. So I see that the Westpac banking product, I think the banks will jump at the opportunity to cannibalise their own distribution force and compete with us. And I actually think that there will be some sponsors of industry funds who will quite willingly take the bank's money and sell themselves. The accountants of all ethical people did it once, so there's no reason why it shouldn't be done again.
Do we have another question or comment?
Well, maybe on that point, certainly banks have established client bases, and I would expect banks to try and leverage off those client bases quite possibly in the way that you're saying.
I think the banks, I used to work for BT, I think the banks and their wealth management arms have struggled for many years, but you see them starting to get it right now. Yes. It's quite interesting. Come on, there must be more questions. So many issues being discussed.
I'm Paul Swinhoe from Deloitte. I guess my biggest disappointment out of recent announcements was nothing changing in the retirement income market. I see it as a growing problem that people will outlive their super, and the government's not yet doing anything about that. Like you, I did a bit of research and got onto my superannuation fund and had a look at its calculator. It's quite amusing to be asked how much do you want to live on in retirement and what do you think your fund's going to earn. And then comes the killer question: how long would you like your retirement income to last?
Forever?
Well, forever wasn't an option. I've been reading some actuarial papers recently, so I wanted to put in an answer a bit greater than 100. But the website wouldn't actually let me. It insisted that I ran out of retirement income at 99. To change this from a diatribe into a question, what do you think the government is going to or should do about it?
Well, look, I think that the trustees have to lift their game when it comes to looking after their members in the post-retirement phase. I think there's a balance here between the best interests of a lot of members will be just rely on the age pension, spend your super. That may be less and less acceptable over time, but and then the other members, you know, the need, there will be members there who will want the security to know that they have a top up on top of that age pension, and it's going to last for the rest of their life. And I think trustees will increasingly need to focus on how to deliver that protection in a cost-effective way for members. So, and that's the challenge, because, you know, the cost-effective bit is the challenge. A lot of us are actuaries in the room. If not all of us are actuaries in the room, we know how much it costs to buy a lifetime annuity.
Okay, little interesting straw poll here. Who thinks that there should be some level of compulsory annuitisation for people's retirement benefits? Show of hands for compulsory annuitisation. I'm an undecided, so I'll have my hand halfway up. Okay, so maybe just over a third of you. Yeah.
I used to.
What changed your mind? When did you have your epiphany? This is getting like Oprah, isn't it?
So, I used to have the view that I guess pretty much like in the UK, where I think it's 75, or I think I heard a figure, 67% of your retirement savings that needs to be used to provide buy an annuity. However, I think that fails to recognise that in Australia there are two other factors at play here. First of all, that the age pension actually is not too bad at providing a very basic level of needs for most Australians. And secondly, we need to make sure that people have flexibility with their savings to meet their needs in the way that suits them. So things like, you know, enabling flexible retirement. So we all heard this morning about the need to increase workforce participation, flexible working arrangements in the 55 to 65 and maybe even to 67 now with the increase in the age pension age. You know, people don't need as much income when they get to the age of 85, you know. Why is it that we lock people in to providing a guaranteed level of income right through to at a certain level right through to retirement, and even worse, arguably, an increasing level? And I saw this in the UK. You know, the government said in 1995 in the UK, all defined benefit pension schemes had to have indexation on your pension in retirement, and all that's doing is taking money away from the retirees when they want to spend it at 65, and giving it to them when they're 85 when they don't want to spend it.
Another comment or question? I'll
come back to you. Margaret Bishop from BNP Paribas. I did sort of mostly want to comment on that, because it's been said a bit today that you don't need a lot of money once you get to sort of plus 85, because you're not going to be going on overseas trips. But I'd just like to point out that you will be needing money in other forms, most likely, because you'll be getting sick and you might need knee reconstructions or hip replacements, or you might have cancer, and those things are going to cost you if you go through the private system, unless of course you're one of these people who is also happy to opt for the public system, which not a lot of people are, and I guess the flip side is you might also end up in aged care, which is also quite expensive. So that's just my 2 cents worth.
Well, all this about, you know, the amount of savings we have, in superannuation, and how much you rely on the on your superannuation for things like aged care or knee replacements or hip replacements or whatever, is all about when do you pay for it and who pays for it. So if you look at, you've either got the option of relying on the state, in which case the cost of the taxes that people pay in the future are going to need to be higher, or you increase the amount of money that people have so they need less of what they get from the state. So it's one of these imponderables, because it's a matter of your own personal belief on the extent to which you should the state should provide for the public.
Rizwan Ali from ING. What's your view on providing like a gap analysis to members to empower them? So we've heard about the problems with projections and so on, but to even give them some level of idea that, you know, in retirement, even as you transition, you might need this amount of money. This is what you might accumulate given what you've currently got in your rate of contribution and so on. Here's a gap. So this person might start thinking about what they could do about it. Could they contribute more? Could they reset their sort of you know, expectations of the future?
Well, and that's got to form part of a concerted effort by trustees to educate their members, supported by appropriate advice or mentoring service or something like that, that the trustees provide to help guide members through that process. I think the certain amount to be said for member education brings them up to a certain level, but then after that, members, you know, they need someone to affirm that they're making the right choices rather than making a choice and finding out 20 years later it was the wrong choice. And that sort of information is helpful in providing that, as long as it's got the support behind it.
Paul Swinhoe again. I wanted to pick up your points on annuitisation. I think it's better to look at annuitisation more flexibly than a fixed income for life. I entirely take your points about the need for flexibility and the need for perhaps extra money when you need long-term care at old age. But at its most basic, annuitisation to me means that if you're unfortunate enough to die relatively young in retirement, let's face it, you don't need the money anymore. And therefore, using that money to pay across to the people who are lucky enough to live long enough to need it is what annuitisation achieves. So that there are a number of mechanisms that could be done for that, but basically, if a value transfer from the short-lived to the long-lived means that everyone's super goes further and lasts as long as they need it to last.
I guess the trouble is our legislation at the moment has a very narrow definition of what an annuity is, so if we can free that up and we can start to have these more modern annuities and tontines and those sort of things that start to meet those needs, we'd be much better off, I think.
The only comment I'd make about that is that, you know, we've as governments, you know, as the industry, the way the industry's moved over the last 20 years, we've been telling people you're responsible for your own retirement, you've got to save your money to provide for your retirement. We're telling people it's their money.
So do we need a new catch cry, do we? It's your money except for this bit.
the point is, if you've told them it's their money, you've got to give them something they value if you're going to say, I'm going to take it away.
Bruce Thompson from Thompson Actuarial. Yeah, it's their money, but they are not the only person with an interest in their money. And if I speak as a taxpayer, then I'm very interested in them spending their money on their retirement rather than me having to subsidise their retirement after they've spent it all on QE2 cruises or something.
Hey, cool, can I come too?
And that's why I put my hand up earlier. I'm in favour of some annuitisation. I think to prevent taxpayers having to support them in their old age, that there should be some annuitisation, enough to keep them, well, keep their hand out of my pocket as a taxpayer.
I mean, it's certainly the case that if you've got state benefits there's a rational, I should say, incentive for people to invest aggressively or take aggressive decisions, because you've always got the downside risk protected. And should we protect, provide that protection when people theoretically have enough money and shouldn't be taking those high-risk options.
Okay, we've got time for one last question.
This is Charles Crean here from Milliman. Yeah, I've got a comment on compulsory annuitisation as well. I mean, from my perspective, it seems to be... It sounds theoretically very good that, you know, the short-lived people subsidise the long-lived people. But just from an individual perspective, I'm not sure if individual investors are willing to accept the fact that they're actually taking on a gamble on their life expectancy. With compulsory annuity, essentially, you're really making a gamble on how long you're going to live. And if you're going to die early, you lose the gamble, the money goes to someone else. I mean, as I said, from a society's perspective, it sounds like a great idea, but from an individual investor's perspective or retiree's perspective, I'm not sure if most people can accept that. And I think, I'm sure that's one of the reasons why the annuity market hasn't really picked up in Australia.
I think that's a fair observation. It's all about the individual versus the community. And as a community, we've got to make the decision about where the balance lies. And my observation was simply that we've pushed people to think about themselves as individuals for a number of years, and the consequences are here.
Well, Daniel, a very interesting presentation, and certainly you got the discussion going. So... congratulations. I know you put a lot of time and effort into preparing it, and it certainly paid off. So
thanks a lot.
Thank you. Please join me in thanking Dan.